I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway. Last week, a gunman in Indianapolis shot and killed 8 of his former colleagues at a FedEx warehouse. And among the victims, 4 were members of the Sikh community. In response, 8 Sikh houses of worship in Indianapolis issued a joint statement that reads in part, quote, "Given everything our community has experienced in the past, the pattern of violence, bigotry, and backlash we have faced, it's impossible not to feel that same pain and targeting in this moment." And here's what one member of the Sikh community in Indianapolis had to say about the shooting.
This is KP Singh calling from Indianapolis, Indiana. We send our prayers and blessings to everyone as the Sikh community in Indiana and around the world commemorates one of the most significant days in the history and journey of the Sikh faith, and yet there is a pale, dark cloud of this event that has taken place the past few days. Together we shall fight and overcome the sadness and rise to comfort those directly impacted. We all have a responsibility to bring back the light and bring back the promise of this blessed land.
If you'd like to share your thoughts with us, please call us at 877-869-8253. I'm joined now by Simranjeet Singh, Senior Fellow at the Sikh Coalition and Visiting Professor at Union Theological Seminary. Simran, thanks for joining me.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
We heard a little bit from a member of the Sikh community in Indianapolis in the introduction, but in terms of, I'm sure you're hearing from lots of people in the community, how are they processing this most recent mass shooting?
Oh, well, I mean, first and foremost, the community is devastated. And that's, you know, the families who lost loved ones, whether they were Sikh or not. You know, half of the families who were affected were Sikh families, and half of them were not. And regardless of your background, losing your loved ones to violence like this is painful. I mean, there's no other real word for it. And so that, I think, is part of the experience. And then another part of the experience is the feeling across Sikh communities in Indianapolis, around the country, across the world. They feel targeted. They feel like this was intentional. You know, the police are reporting today that the killer had visited white supremacist websites. We know that he should not have had access to guns. They had been taken away from him previously. He got access to guns again. We know that he used to work with these people, many of whom were Punjabi Sikh immigrants at this FedEx facility. They would have turbans and beards just like me, and brown skin and accents. And for him to go into a place like that and to massacre his former coworkers, it doesn't feel anything short of targeted hate. And that's an experience and a feeling that our community knows all too well. But to have to go through it at this scale, once again, it's just painful for everyone involved.
You're talking, when you say the Sikh community knows this experience all too well, you point that out in an op-ed you wrote for CNN, where you talk about the 20 years since the terrorist attacks of 9/11 and the backlash that ensued. I remember interviewing a woman who married into a Sikh community and was a taxi driver here in New York City, and who was wearing her her outfit and her salwar kameez and was attacked by her passenger around that time. Is that the type of hatred and violence that you're concerned about?
Right, exactly. And I mean, living here in New York City for the past 10 years, I can give you all sorts of personal stories like that. Working with the Sikh Coalition, a civil rights organization based here in New York City, I can share anecdotes from people of all backgrounds within the city who have been attacked in all sorts of spaces. I mean, I've been subjected to racist hate while running the New York City Marathon. I've had it while taking my kids to school. I mean, it comes in all forms. And so that's part of the experience too, that you know that in a moment like this, when the climate is such that hate is affecting all types of communities across the board, and to have to reconcile its reality in the most visceral way, to face death within this community, you can't help but wonder, what's next? Is it my parents? Is it me? Is it my kids? And that reality, I mean, it's too much to carry on a day-to-day basis, but we have to. And so those are the kinds of attacks precisely that have been in part and parcel of the Sikh experience in America. And, you know, so much of our conversation when we talk about this, the narrative is, well, this is a post-9/11 phenomenon. This is a post-Trump phenomenon. And those things are true. Things have gotten worse in certain moments where our community has been targeted increasingly. You know, for example, from 2017 to 2018, we saw 200% increase in reported hate crimes against Sikhs. I mean, ask any statistician, 200% increase is ridiculous. Like, we don't hear those kinds of numbers. And so those are true, but also at the same time, when we limit our understandings to the current moment, to our own experiences, we fail to recognize the long history of white supremacy and racism in this country. And so to really understand that, we have to look to the very foundation of this country, and also to the beginnings of Sikh experiences here, where within years of coming, racist backlash, attacks, race riots, targeting Sikhs and South Asians. And that's, I think that's an important part of the story and our psychology as well.
Simran, we should just be clear that the police in Indianapolis have yet to determine, or at least to call this a hate crime, as they continue to seek some motivation here on the part of the shooter. But your point remains in that the shooter had had visited white supremacist websites, had already been interviewed by the FBI at least a year prior to this shooting. And one thing I don't think a lot of folks know about is that there is a sizable Sikh population in Indiana and Indianapolis. How did that come to be?
Oh, well, I mean, it's a great point, first of all, that we don't actually know the motive of the killer. I mean, we can say it. We know enough to say that in a situation like this, hate was part of his motive, right? How do you massacre people, human beings, without hate being part of the equation? We don't know if racial bias was animating him. And so there's a really important distinction here to be made between bias and our legal categories of what constitutes a hate crime, right? In a hate crime, we need pure, clear evidence that he was doing this, that he killed these people out of racial hate. And in most situations, whether it's in a case like this or it's in a case like someone attacking a Sikh taxi driver here in the city, in most situations, no one is announcing why they're attacking you, right? It's very rare that somebody comes after me and says, I hate you because of your turban and your beard. So I think that's a challenge in our understanding of what it constitutes a hate crime in this country. And at the same time, we know with the research that is increasingly pointing to this reality that we all have biases. And we all have racial bias. And in a situation like this, where he would have known these people at this facility were largely Punjabi Sikh immigrants, it's hard to imagine. It's hard to separate out the bias that he would be carrying, like the rest of us carry, from his action. So I think that's an important point to be made. With regard to the Indianapolis Sikh community, I would say, you know, Sikhs have been in this country now for about 125 years. They initially, like most immigrant communities, came to the West Coast, came to the East Coast. And as the communities grew, they started dispersing across the country. And so Indiana has about 8,000 to 10,000 Sikhs within the state. In Indianapolis itself, they have 8 to 10 gurdwaras, places of Sikh worship. So it's a substantial community there. Many of them worked at this FedEx facility. Many of them in Indianapolis are working class backbone of America people. And I think that's really important to recognize too, because it's heart crushing to hear some stories coming out of this community. And people are saying, well, you know, one of the men who was killed, Jasvinder Singh, he had just started working there. And one of the reasons he started working there was because he was bored at home and he wanted to be in community with fellow Punjabi Sikhs, where he could speak his native language and talk about life back home. I mean, a classic immigrant experience. And I've heard that so many times from people who work at that facility. So part of what's brought these six to Indianapolis is jobs like this. In the same way that we see a lot of folks moving to the Midwest, looking for better opportunities and more affordable lives for their families.
You were part of a White House virtual gathering with members of the American Sikh community. Tell us about that event and what exactly would you like to see from the Biden-Harris administration in response to this shooting? Because we know that hate crimes towards Asian American Americans have been on the rise, and the Biden administration is aware of that and has made at least initial efforts to respond to that. But what would you like to see specifically in regard to this?
One of the strange parts of the experience for me was the first person who informed me about the shooting in Indianapolis was actually a friend who works at the White House. You know, he called that morning and asked if I'd heard about the shooting. And I had said, yes, I saw the headline. But I think with like most Americans, I sighed heavily and felt sad and moved on because it felt like just another mass shooting. And then he informed me that a number of Sikhs had been killed as far as he had understood at that point. It hadn't yet been confirmed, but he was hearing the reports. And he wanted to set up a conversation. And he asked me to help facilitate that. And you know, to me, what that demonstrates is the humanity of this administration, the outrage, the personal connection, which I think has been missing in this country for far too long, like, especially in our case as a community that's largely invisibilized, right? People don't see us. We're not part of the conversation. For them to reach out and to say, let's convene a meeting with local leaders on the ground and folks at the Sikh Coalition who are the leaders in the civil rights space to figure out what to do. And so we had a wonderful call, a very productive conversation with many federal officials in attendance, many members of the local Sikh community who were affected directly, and many folks from the Sikh Coalition. And we heard the stories of those who were hurting most. And we heard from the experts in the room in terms of what we would like to see. And I'll name a couple of the big asks. And one was to appoint a liaison for the Sikh community in the White House, given our particular needs and concerns. Another was to pass stronger legislation dealing with hate crimes and supporting communities who are dealing with hate. And the third big ask for the White House officials was to help support places of worship that are affected by violence and hate, and for these communities to get the active support of the federal government.
Simranjeet Singh is a senior fellow at the Sikh Coalition and a visiting professor at Union Theological Seminary. President Biden has promised to reverse some of the central pieces of the Trump administration's hardline immigration policies. So last week, when he announced that he would keep a Trump-era limit on the number of refugees admitted to the United States, many of his allies were shocked. So far, only 2,050 refugees have been admitted to the United States this year. That's the lowest number since the refugee program began in 1980. In response to the widespread pushback from within his own party, the Biden administration has backpedaled and now say they will be raising the cap by mid-May. On Monday, White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki placed most of the blame on the Trump administration.
Given the fact that the processing, the asylum processing, has been hollowed out from the State Department, and also the ORR, the Office of Refugee Resettlement, has also been hollowed out in terms of personnel, staffing, and financial and funding needs, we have every intention to increase the cap and to make an announcement of that by May 15th at the latest, and I expect it will be sooner than that. The president also remains committed to pursuing the aspirational goal of reaching 125,000 refugees by the end of the next fiscal year.
Catherine Rampell is a columnist for The Washington Post. Catherine, great to have you back.
Great to be here.
So Jen Psaki said that the interesting choice of words here. She said it's an aspirational goal to have 125,000 refugees by the end of the next fiscal year. But she also started by blaming the Trump administration for this very low number of refugees. What do you make of that?
So it is true that the Trump administration did everything it within its power to dismantle an already pretty broken immigration system, making it harder to come here, not just through the border wall, but basically foreclosing every legal avenue to immigration as well. And that included employment-based visas, family-sponsored visas, et cetera, and of course, refugee admissions. So it is true that the Trump administration sabotaged the immigration system. However, some of those elements of the immigration system are easier to repair than others, one of which is just raising the refugee admission ceiling. The sitting president has almost plenary power to just set the cap on the number of refugees who can come in. It's not like DACA, where you need Congress to get on board with a permanent legislative fix, or you need congressional involvement for fixing all sorts of other elements, or even with the border crisis, which is a very complicated issue, and you have to worry about, you know, the push factors and the pull factors and all of that. With refugees, it's relatively straightforward. And in February, in fact, Biden had announced that he was going to quadruple the record low refugee admission ceiling set by Trump from 15,000. Again, that was the lowest it had ever been, up to 62,500. And refugee resettlement agencies, which have, have struggled in the past few years, these are private nonprofits who contract with the government, celebrated this. But then something very odd happened where the current president, President Biden, just didn't sign the paperwork to put his own policy into effect. And it is true that it will take a fair amount of work to, you know, rebuild all of this infrastructure to get to the 125,000 refugee goal that they have announced for next year. But simply allowing in people who were already kind of in that pipeline, who were ready to go, was a much easier endeavor that for some reason Biden was dragging his feet on and had declined to explain what the source of the delay was. As a result, there were hundreds of refugees who had been booked on flights by the State Department, by Biden's own State Department, who were then unbooked because the previous president's restrictions were still in effect. And after months of questions for the administration about what was going on, finally, you got to this point last week where the Biden administration said, okay, we're actually going to keep Trump's ceiling in place, but we're going to loosen some of the eligibility requirements. And I think that they thought that this was a compromise that would get everyone off their backs. And of course, that was not what happened.
Why would they? I mean, Joe Biden has been in politics for nearly half of his life. I mean, he had to understand that keeping the Trump level cap was going to receive some type of backlash from his allies, especially since he's essentially going back on what his administration promised they would do. What's your take on how the Democrats have responded to this so far?
I think what happened is that the ghost of Stephen Miller is still sort of haunting the White House. That Stephen Miller and other xenophobes who had advised the previous administration on immigration issues worked to kind of confuse the general public about the differences between different groups of immigrants, to kind of convince everyone that all immigrants are somehow intrinsically criminal and illegal, right? That there is no possible way that you can trust a foreigner and that they all must be expelled and, denied entry to the United States. And so I think the Biden folks basically were very worried that the public would read headlines about refugee admissions, and refugees are people who are currently abroad, who submit to years and years and years of background checks and medical screening and things like that before they can come here. People would confuse that with the surge of migrants at the border, many of whom are also persecuted people who are applying for asylum. And so they kind of thought, well, we're afraid, I think this is what was going on. I think that they were afraid that Republicans were going to conflate the issues and confuse the public. And rather than just saying, okay, we're going to explain to the public, you know, how these different groups of immigrants are treated differently under the law and under screening processes and what our infrastructure is in place, et cetera, they just kind of threw up their hands and said, whatever, we're going to get too much blowback if we let these refugees in. And they didn't they didn't anticipate that what would actually happen is that their allies would say, hey, why did you go back on your word?
Is Biden, I mean, let's be clear here. Biden was vice president under President Obama, who was called the deporter in chief. Is Biden influenced by any Obama era policies or strategy here, or is this purely his own thinking?
If you look at what Biden has said over the years, he has been very pro-immigrant in general and pro-refugee in particular. And he has spoken warmly about the need to welcome in the stranger. He's worked with faith groups on this issue. Faith groups often are very active on refugee admissions issues. And so I think this is something that he deeply cares about. You may recall also during the presidential primary, I think there was a bit of a tussle in one of the early Democratic presidential debates about this, where Biden kind of said that he did not necessarily agree with all of the things that the Obama administration had done. But where Biden has talked the talk, it's frustrating that he hasn't always walked the walk once he got into office. And I don't mean to dismiss, again, a lot of the very complicated efforts that are necessary to unwind the many, many, like hundreds of Trump policies that need to be unwound. That's all difficult, and that will take some time. And I think that they are making progress on a number of those issues, reversing the public charge rule, for example, even sort of more symbolic things like changing the verbiage from alien to immigrant or non-citizen throughout regulations and things like that. So they are doing quite a bit. But on this particularly visible issue of refugee admissions, it's very perplexing why they've been dragging their feet. And the only thing, again, that I can attribute it to is potentially fear of public criticism, particularly from Republicans.
The optics, as they are called often in D.C. speak. Catherine, what effect is this going to have on refugees who are waiting to be admitted to the U.S.?
So there are 26 million refugees overall around the world. I think there's something like 1.5, 1.4 million who are thought to be in need of resettlement this year. Setting a ceiling of 15,000 for admissions is obviously a drop in the bucket. These are people who have been waiting years and years and years, often in pretty awful conditions, in fear of their life. And those awful conditions have often gotten worse because of the public health crisis. So for the people who are waiting, I mean, obviously, this is very discouraging. Now, if Biden, in fact, raises the refugee admission ceiling again, that would provide some level of hope. But we're already more than halfway through the fiscal year. I don't know exactly how much faster we can speed up admissions at this point and not have Biden end up as the president overseeing the lowest refugee admissions level in modern history. And then the other thing to consider, of course, is that there were, as I mentioned before, there were a number of refugees who had flights booked and canceled in March and who had, as a result, given away all of their belongings, vacated whatever housing they were occupying, who were put in an even tougher spot. And my hope is by loosening those eligibility standards, as Biden has done, at least some of those people will be able to have their travel expedited.
Catherine Rampell is a columnist for The Washington Post. Catherine, thanks so much.
Thank you.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, the New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.
For the sixth year in a row, sexually transmitted diseases and infections are on the rise in the United States. That's according to the latest data from the Centers for Disease Control. According to the CDC, there were 2.5 million reported cases of chlamydia, gonorrhea, and syphilis across the country in 2019. And while many Americans have been in quarantine for the past year, as the country begins to open up and more people get vaccinated, experts are concerned that we could see a spike in infections. For more on this, I'm joined by Professor Ina Park, the author of Strange Bedfellows, Adventures in Science, History, and Surprising Secrets of STDs. Ina, welcome to the show.
It's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Ina, I recall a time when, in the 1990s in particular, when the messaging around STDs and STIs was very clear. And largely that was because, I'm sure you recall, the rise of HIV and AIDS really brought to the forefront the need to practice safe sex. So when I saw these numbers, it was really surprising to me that this is the sixth year in a row that we've seen this increase. What's behind these numbers?
Well, I can't point to any one factor, but you're right. You and I grew up during a time where everyone knew what HIV was and how it was transmitted, and therefore, you know, we should know how to prevent it. But just because we knew how to prevent something didn't necessarily mean we did. And of course, we know that things like condoms and barriers do help prevent STIs and HIV, but a lot of other forces are at play here. One of which you already mentioned, were the dating apps. So, you know, they have allowed the ability to create casual hookups with the efficiency that we never could have imagined before, and also allows mixing of sexual networks. So we used to have to go down to, you know, the local bar to meet somebody. And so you were, you know, generally hanging out in similar social circles, but now, you know, you can turn any location into a place where you might be able to meet someone to hook up for sex. So I think the efficiency, as well as the spread in geography, has, you know, changed the way that we connect with each other sexually in space and time. And then the other thing is that we are much less afraid as a society of HIV now, which is a wonderful thing, because now we have medications, antiretroviral therapy, that can prolong the lives of folks with HIV so that they have basically a normal lifespan. And when you take the medication, then you're, you know, unable, if your virus is suppressed, to transmit. So you have folks not afraid of HIV, able to hook up really easily. And then out here in California, Tanzania, we have a pretty serious problem with the methamphetamine epidemic. And then, of course, you know, the opioid epidemic nationally, which is very tied to syphilis, particularly among women and then pregnant women.
What do we know about sexual education in schools? I mean, that's another place where I recall learning a lot about safe sex practices and a lot of these STDs and STIs. Do we know whether that's still happening?
Well, I mean, I think you and I grew up in bubbles to a certain extent. That I was in California, you were in New York, and we had pretty medically accurate, skills-based sex education, where we were learning how to put on condoms and that type of thing. That is very unusual. Really, only 18 states in the United States actually dictate that the classes that you teach for sex education have to be medically accurate. You know, probably most of them are reasonably accurate. 39 states and the District of Columbia actually do mandate some form of sex education. But most of these, you know, are often disease-focused or harm-focused, and they don't certainly, you know, teach skills about negotiating things like consent or teaching folks how to use condoms necessarily. So I think the quality of sex ed that people are receiving is highly variable and often not very good.
The data that the CDC has put forth in this report is from 2019. And mm-hmm. Of course, everybody knows what happened in 2020 was that the world changed and we were all sent home. Some of us are slowly beginning to emerge from home, and that will probably mean more interactions. But before we get to what's on the horizon, mm-hmm. Do we know about what happened during the pandemic in terms of people's sexual lives and potentially the spread of STDs and STIs?
Well, only in a preliminary way in terms of looking at CDC data, because it's not all complete yet. But they talked about, you know, some of their preliminary 2020 data at the end of 2020 at their STD prevention conference. And it did look like in those, you know, early months of shelter in place that people truly were socially and sexually distancing from each other. But the other thing that was going on, Tanzina, was about two-thirds of sexual health clinics actually had to either shut their doors or greatly reduce their services. So I'm just going to take New York City, for example. they have 8 sexual health clinics, and they actually had to shut the doors on 7 of them. So if you can imagine, in a city that large, I really have only 1 sexual health clinic. So folks couldn't even get access to testing. And then, of course, you know, people truly did reduce their in real life sort of sexual interactions, but people certainly went online. I mean, Tinder had a record of 3 billion swipes on March 29th of 2020. So
no, people it did were interacting. Really?
Yes, 3 billion really? Swipes. And they were interacting with each other. But I think a lot of people early on were too freaked out to do, you know, sexual encounters in person. But just from my own patients that I see, I'll tell you, some people never stopped having casual sex. And then other people held up for a couple months, and then they just got right back on the horse again, so to speak.
We're starting to slowly reopen again in many parts of the country, and there are bars and restaurants opening up. And I suspect that there will be, as people become fully vaccinated, there will be a lot more sex happening. What does that tell us potentially about the future for STIs and STDs as we emerge from the pandemic?
Well, looking into my crystal ball, I have to say, in talking to some patients who have held out for quite a while and are now getting back out there, I think there is a little bit of making up for lost time, I have to say, Tanzina, where folks have felt deprived for such a long time. And that whole idea of quarantine fatigue is real. And so I think people feel like, hey, I deserve to have a great time. And even folks who were extraordinarily compliant with masking are not necessarily excited about using condoms. They don't translate for some reason. And it's interesting because I had just put out a piece last week in the Times with my colleague Peggy Orenstein, and she interviewed Lisa Wade over at Tulane, and she found she's interviewing college students who, as you know, are a pretty highly sexually active group. And even those with multiple partners report not using condoms, even though they do report, you know, being really compliant with masks. So I think in my crystal ball, I see a huge spike in STIs in 2021, but we'll see if I'm right or not.
Is that just because people don't assume that they will get something like gonorrhea or syphilis? You know, when I think about syphilis, I say, well, isn't that the thing that killed, you know, Elizabethan writers? And, you know, like, or is it just because people don't think it's that serious?
I think people understand by now that an STI can enter the picture really at any time that you have sex. And I think that it's just that people aren't overly concerned or taking it as seriously. And now that folks are less afraid of HIV, I think they haven't placed a lot of importance, you know, on things like syphilis. And I do have to say, for a certain generation of physicians, including myself, we almost eliminated syphilis in this country in 1999 and 2000. So now that it's surged again, we have an entire generation of physicians who's also not familiar with seeing it. And so we're not counseling about it necessarily. And so I think there's a combination of folks just not feeling like it's going to cause any long-term effects. And of course, you and I both know, not just syphilis, but gonorrhea, chlamydia, and other STIs can certainly cause a whole host of complications. So, you know, I definitely advocate for folks to, you know, get out there and get tested, regardless of whether or not they're going to use protection.
Well, let's talk about testing, because I wonder how much is assumed that you're being tested for, how much when you go to your gynecologist or urologist, you know, what exactly can you get tested for?
Right. So you can get tested for the, you know, 3 big bacterial STIs that CDC reports on, which are gonorrhea, chlamydia, and syphilis, are pretty much standard across the board. Of course, everyone can get tested for HIV. There are tests for human papillomavirus, or HPV, which right now are only done with folks with the cervix when it's done during like the pap smear procedure, pelvic exam. And then, there are blood tests for herpes. I have a chapter about this in my book because they're very prone to false positives. And so we only do that herpes test in very certain circumstances, because when you get a result, it's sometimes hard to interpret. So one thing that is easier to interpret, which everyone is familiar with, are these PCR tests. So if somebody actually has something going on, like a genital lesion, those PCR tests, which are really similar to the COVID tests that we're all familiar with, are very accurate at diagnosing herpes. But for a standard sort of test me for STDs panel, it would really just be gonorrhea, chlamydia, syphilis, and then sometimes HIV.
People would have to ask for HIV or HPV if they wanted that test.
Yeah, they shouldn't have to ask for HIV. I wish it would, you know, always be included. But it's always good to ask sort of, what are you testing me for? Mm-hmm. But HPV, you know, really, there's no FDA approved test for men. So in general, men should not be getting tested for HPV.
The Department of Health and Human Services has an STI National Strategic Plan. Your thoughts on it?
Oh, I'm so excited about this. I mean, this is the first ever plan. We have one for HIV. And this plan, National Strategic Plan, just went into place in 2021. And one of my favorite aspects about it, well, there's two. The first is that they want to have a non-stigmatizing, comprehensive approach to sexual health education and sexual well-being. And that sounds completely reasonable, but that will be a huge lift if we're actually able to get our nation to a place where everyone is receiving that sort of comprehensive sex ed. And then the second thing is, there's a goal to try to reduce the stigma around sexually transmitted infections and HIV, because as you know, stigma is still a huge issue that prevents folks from testing because they're embarrassed or they're afraid that they might be rejected if they actually have an STI and then have to tell their partner.
Ina Park is the author of Strange Bedfellows, Adventures in Science, History, and Surprising Secrets of STDs. Ina, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Tanzine. It was great to be here.
And spring has officially sprung. And if you're anything like me, you've been spending a lot more time just noticing things. Like the songs of sparrows outside your apartment window, or the purple crocuses bursting into bloom in a nearby park, or even asteroids shooting across the night sky. But did you know those kinds of observations could actually be helpful to scientists? In fact, during the pandemic, as many of us have been forced to stay close to home, we've seen a growing number of people participating in something called citizen or community science. That's when people like you and me voluntarily collect data out in the world or in our own backyards to help professional scientists study everything from migratory patterns of butterflies to neighborhood air quality. For more on this, I'm joined by Katie Prudick, an assistant professor of citizen and data science at the University of Arizona. Katie, welcome to the show.
Hi, I'm so excited to be here.
First of all, there is a citizen and data science professorship at the University of Arizona. I just heard about citizen science. How long has this been around?
Oh, well, sort of in the mainstream U.S. culture, I would say probably 10 years is when it really started going. And there's been a lot of organizations. We have a professional society. And that's been really sort of facilitated by smartphones and technology, I would say. But if we go back, you know, through time and across cultures, then, you know, probably my favorite data set that I always like to point out to people is one about cherry blossoms that goes back to 800 AD. I think it was in the news lately about the Kyoto cherry blossoms being earlier this year than they have been since like the 1200s.
So folks, average non-scientist folks who are interested in what's happening around them, particularly now, I mean, I was talking to our team about this story yesterday and saying how I'm noticing nature a lot more closely this year because of the pandemic. Are you seeing more people involved in this type of citizen scientist community because of the pandemic?
Well, I do want to say that citizen science incorporates a lot of different things beyond just nature and biodiversity. It includes astronomy. It even includes public health and public utilities and those sorts of things. But if we focus just in on the nature part of it, I published a paper recently with a colleague, Teresa Crimmins, and we found that urban areas had an uptick in community or citizen science participation, but people weren't traveling as much to rural areas to watch birds or butterflies or plants.
So what are some examples of what we're seeing today? What kind of projects are people doing? And then how are the pros finding out about this, these projects?
Yeah, as I mentioned before, I mean, the projects are quite varied. Think of citizen science as you would any other scientific technique that goes across disciplines. It's a way to mobilize and organize people who are interested in what you do to collect larger amounts of data over more space and time, or to, you know, really burrow in a certain location and get really in-depth data. So it's just, you know, sort of collecting an army of people to help you out, right? And so what have the pros been learning? Depends on the question, of course, but certainly in the nature world, we've been learning a lot about migration, about species range changes, about changes in phenology as they relate to climate change, and phenology is seasonality. So right now, what you would see is changes in bloom time. So when blossoms of those crocuses are coming out, or when grass is starting, or even when those song sparrows start to sing at you at those early hours of the morning.
How has the pandemic disrupted the ability of professional scientists to collect their data, given the lockdowns and quarantines and travel restrictions we've seen?
Yeah, I think, you know, especially in the beginning, there was a huge sort of disruption to data collection. I know many of my colleagues' labs were shut down or limited to one person in the lab at a time. I think now with masking and vaccines and those sorts of things, protocols have been established where we've ramped up our data collection again, which is great, and data analysis. But, you know, it is really important to have that engagement with citizen science. And I think it's important for a few reasons. One is the scale of the data you can collect. Another is the perspectives that community scientists bring to the table. I think as a professional, I've learned a tremendous amount from other people who have been out in the field observing and so excited to share what they saw. And that gives me not just inspiration, but also a different perspective of how to approach my work.
Are the citizen scientists we're talking about folks that are posting, say, photos of or sounds of the birds that they're listening to and on social media, and that's how scientists, the professionals, are learning about this? Or are there more formal channels for citizen scientists to sort of get their data, if you will, in the hands of the professional scientists?
Yes, certainly we can definitely use Flickr or some sort of repository like that to sort of scrub data off. But I prefer the sort of more specialized web platforms that you alluded to. Certainly the most popular one right now, I would say, is eBird for those birders out there. But there's also other ones like iNaturalist, which is agnostic in terms of the biology. It's any species, really. And then I developed a web platform with colleagues that's called eButterflies, focusing on butterflies. And then there's also a phenology platform called Nature's Notebook, run through the National Phenology Network.
During the pandemic, there has been an increase in anti-science movements here in the United States. What does the community science mean for trust in science overall?
I think it provides a space where we can share what we enjoy and share what we all discover, regardless of your political leanings or your background or your location spatially. I think what I've really enjoyed about that is that once you have a shared interest, then it's easier to start having conversations and sort of understand people who come from different viewpoints.
And how far do you see, are there any new emerging trends of science that citizen scientists may have pointed out for you all?
Oh, yeah. So there's been some really great discoveries about migration, certainly species range expansions or contractions related to climate change. We just published a paper on a butterfly that folks might know out east, the eastern giant swallowtail. It seems to be moving north at the fastest rate of any known animal. So that's kind of fun. Now, folks have a lot of opportunities to find their place in citizen science. I would recommend going to SciStarter, SciStarter.org, to look for different projects that are available to them. And it's really just about finding a community that speaks to you and a process that's enjoyable for you to go out and explore the world.
Katie Prudick is an assistant professor of citizen and data science at the University of Arizona. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
This is Chris from Richmond, California. I'm an outdoor photographer and have been using the iNaturalist app for years. It helps me sound smart when I can identify birds and other critters, and it benefits the local scientific community as well. So it's win-win.
Hey there. This is Lisha from Ashland, Wisconsin. And I'm just letting you know about The Go Sky Watch and the Go ISS Watch apps are very, very good for observing the International Space Station and stars and planets. Wonderful to use, very easy, and so much fun.
My name is Mike from Worcester, Massachusetts. I absolutely use my bird identification app when I take my walk in the woods each morning. It's always fun to start to figure out who is joining me today and yesterday and who may be there tomorrow. It's a good thing to do during these times that we are living in, for sure. The birds seem to know what's important, and I enjoy what I might be learning from them.
Hi, my name is Julia Hansing. I'm in Portland, Oregon. And in terms of science apps, the main ones that I use are both of Starwalk and Skywalk, which are fabulous apps for identifying constellations and planetary functions. And I also use the Garden Answers and Plantit for plant identification. They're excellent. So I think it's a real exciting aspect of using technology for expanding our world. Thank you.
That's our show for today, folks. Thanks for listening. And of course, we'd love to hear from you, so keep calling us with comments or ideas at 877-8-MY-TAKE. That's 877-869-8253. Or tweet us. We're at The Takeaway. And you can tweet me, too. I'm at Tanzina Vega. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Tanzina Vega. This is The Takeaway, and we'll see you tomorrow.